This is how you elevate yourself from what we affectionately refer to as an order taker. Like, do you want fries with that? To having a strategic business communication marketing conversation with your client so that you can help them achieve their goal.
You're listening to the No BS Agency Podcast. We talk strategies that can take your 1-2 person branding agency from $5,000 to $30,000 per month without hiring employees or working your ass off. All you have to do is cut the BS. I am Pia Silva. On today's episode, I have a very special guest that you have probably heard of, the one and only Chris Doe. Chris is a huge name in our industry. He's known as the future. He has an incredibly large community. He's got an amazing following on TikTok and YouTube. He's got some really brilliant insights to share with us. And I know a lot of you and a lot of our listeners have been listening to Chris too, and that's precisely why I wanted to have him on the show. Now, what you'll hear from our interview is that Chris has clearly got a different business model and a different approach to working with clients. And that's kind of exactly why I wanted to invite him on. Because on the surface, it may sound pretty different. Like, he sees 20-person agencies as a small business, and he sees a lot of value in growing businesses to that size and beyond. Whereas we, of course, here, we're all about staying small. We want to stay a 1-2-person branding agency, at least in the meantime, because we want freedom and flexibility, and we also don't really have a desire to build that kind of team. But he has super legit reasons for why he prefers to build a business that way. And lots of people in the world want those kinds of businesses. But despite those differences, if you scratch the surface, many of his positions are actually incredibly similar to the No BS way. For example, he's got some brilliant things to say about the importance of articulating your thoughts, or the importance of asking the right questions, or impressing clients with the kind of quality questions that you ask. These are all exactly what we also teach inside No BS with the lead product process. He's going to talk about the importance of clout and credentials and gaining trust with your clients. That's what all of our authority building is all about. So I think what I got from this interview is that despite having very different models and very different goals, fundamentally, we're doing the same thing. And so I thought it'd be really fun and interesting for you guys to hear those different perspectives too. So without further ado, here is my interview with the future, Chris Doe. Well, Chris, thanks for coming on the show. I'm really happy to have you. So many of my students are such big fans of your work. They've been influenced by you. Jason Knight, who introduced us, Kia Abrera, who I know you know pretty well, people that I just adore, so many others. So I know we have a lot of overlap in who we're preaching to and who we're talking to. So I'm just really thankful that you're here to talk it out, see where we overlap and see where we may disagree.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I'm sure we agree on many things, and it'll be fun to kind of see where there might be some light between our two different philosophies.
I believe you come from a big agency background. You own a big agency, and growing teams is a part of at least what you preach. I thought we could kind of start there. Like, could you talk a little bit about the idea of staying small versus growing a team? I've seen some really great content from you about the idea of hiring people in-house and why that's so important. And I thought we could just start there. Like, what is the philosophy behind what you're teaching for these smaller businesses? And what do you, where do you think they should ultimately go?
Very good question. I don't run a big agency, but relatively speaking, compared to a 1 or 2 person operation, they might think it's big. I think right. At our biggest, we were probably 18 people on staff with 2 offices, one in New York, one in LA, with a legion of freelancers working with us on a contract basis, where we could have as many as 30 or 40 freelancers working with us simultaneously at any given point in time. But I don't want people to think, oh, he's running a 200 person design agency. I'm not. It's just relative.
It's so relative. Yes. That's a huge agency to our audience.
Okay.
Right? So let's define these words. Yeah.
Okay.
Let's continue.
So I think the first thing that we need to take into consideration is kind of lifestyle that we want to live. And I think we can get caught up in that, oh, it looks really good to have lots of people, a fancy office, and an office manager, a receptionist. project managers and all kinds of stuff, because that's what we think success looks like. And you'll quickly find out that until you get to a certain size, you have a diminishing return of investment, that the more people you hire, you'll gross more, but your bottom line net revenue will actually decrease relative to the amount of revenue that you're bringing in. So when my wife and I, when we were running our small design motion practice, I think we had like four people working for us. That was the highest period of profit we've ever had. We've never, ever come close to that ever again. We're talking about running, I think, 85% gross profit margins with probably 65, 70% net. We're swimming in cash back then. So I appreciate and applaud every single person who's running a one or two person operation. Gives you a lot of control, allows you to maximize, in theory, your net profit, but more importantly, to live the lifestyle that you want to live. There's some downsides to it, obviously. The downside is if you're sick, if you don't feel it, whatever that means to you, you don't make money. It's very hard to make money when it's just you doing all the different jobs that you do. So for me, the reason why I wanted to scale my practice, my agency, is a couple different things. Repetition bores me. Like once I feel like I've learned something, I've mastered it, I get more joy by teaching other people how to do that. It's the educator in me who wants to do that. But this is how I'm able to scale myself, my time, and able to charge or build a bigger agency. And I don't like playing solo, like in a band. I'm not a solo piano player. I'm more of a conductor of an orchestra, and I'm inspired by the individuals who bring tremendous amounts of talent, and I like working with them. We elevate each other. So there's a fork in the road. It's like, do you want to stay small? You want to stay nimble if you want to be super profitable, but comes with it a certain amount of risk. The key person in the insurance thing, like if you go down, the whole thing goes down. I'm a solo practitioner. I don't really like to collaborate. I want to keep things simple. I want to be involved in all aspects from beginning to end, high quality control. Versus I'm a conductor. I love to teach. And I think one of the fundamental skills of being an entrepreneur is to be a great educator. You're transferring your operating system to other people. And that's what makes you a great entrepreneur, a great leader versus the manager. So two sides, pick your poison.
I love what you just said. And I think I can't imagine anyone listening doesn't think that that sounds amazing. I have also had, you know, my husband and I also ran our branding agency together, most profitable when it's just the two of us. Now I have a different business where I'm teaching. So scaling, have a team. So I've seen both sides of this as well. And my experience was bridging the gap between having complete control over the projects and getting to a place where I could have that team was quite a bumpy road. Mm. And the skill set that I had to build that took years to build was all over the place in order to get to a place where I could actually have a team doing that. And so I'm curious, you've built a much bigger business than I have. Like, what is the difference about what you need to be good at? And where do you get those skills when you're just starting as a one to two person team?
I try my best to lay out a step-by-step process for anybody who's thinking about this or is feeling that pain. Like, I could use a person to help me with this, right? The easiest thing that you can do is to reach out to a local college or university and post a job offer for an intern. I think this is low risk for both you and that person, and you don't want to be spending a lot of time or money investing in some hotshot that then you later learn you don't know how to manage people and they're actually not as good as you think relative to the amount of money you're paying them. So let's keep the risk low. And a lot of people are dying for job work experience, and sometimes they can get school credit where you don't even need to pay them. I like to pay people. I prefer that because I think about like my time when I was interning, I had to pay for my own gas, my own lunch. It just felt like it was a negative operation for me. So you don't have to pay them a ton of money. Wherever you are, just be somewhat competitive. Be in the range of Starbucks if you can. You don't have to match them per se, but just be close to that. And then you would have an intern. And the first thing that I would tell you to do is just say, for the first week or so, I just want you to shadow me. There's no work expectations from you at all. At the end of every important meeting or task, we'll talk. I just want you to watch how I work, and I want you to just write down notes and ask me questions when it's relevant, because I need you just to kind of get the lay of the land. And then eventually I'm going to give you some tasks to do, and they'll be really simple. What I'm trying to teach you are discrete skills that are fairly simple to learn, but when put together in combination is an advanced skill. I'll give you the example. One of the things I spent a lot of time doing is finding images. Just finding images is a skill in itself. And it starts to refine your sense of taste. So if I'm like looking for an image of a person in an office environment, I don't want stock looking photos. I don't want things that look really set up in corporate. I want something that's cool, even though we're going on a stock photography site. Or I'm looking for inspiration for packaging, which I want to show the client. And I need you to crawl up all over Behance. I need you to crawl up into Instagram and design blogs and find cool things, put them together, organize it so that we can have a discussion. So what we're doing right now is we're aligning our taste level. And one of the biggest skills that you need to have in the 21st century, especially in the age of AI, is to have high taste, to know what looks good and what doesn't, and know how to get it there. Those are two very discrete skills. So that's what my intern will probably be doing, just finding a bunch of images. At the end of the day, they put in a folder, we sit down, no, that's good. Oh, this is amazing. Find me four more like this. And then you start to like align. Okay, that's a task. Cutting out images in Photoshop. I'm doing that all the time because I want to have a clean composite. So just that one task will teach you probably 6 or 7 different techniques in just image production. This is production work. And it's going to feel a little bit like The Karate Kid if people are old enough to remember that movie, like wax on, wax off, paint the fence. And then you're like, I'm not learning karate. And then all of a sudden you wake up and you're like, wait a minute, these are great skills to have. One of the things when I used to teach at the different art schools close by where I live is they know that when you work in the field, your decision-making, your taste level, your techniques make you 5, sometimes 10 times faster than when you were in school. Because you're actually working next to someone who's been doing this for 5, 10, 20 years. There's a lot to learn from them that you're not going to learn on your own. So it's a good exchange of value. You teach them skills, they give you labor at not a high price. And eventually some of those people are what I would consider like hiring material. But if nothing else, these are great training wheels for you to practice managing people, finding talent, giving direction, and just making sure you understand how to build the proper company culture.
I love your focus on building taste. I mean, I sometimes talk about like designers tend to start as the hands, but really when you get into the more strategic design, you're really becoming a curator, right? It's the hands, but it's the curation. It's your eye to be able to pick up on what it might take even less time. Can we talk a little bit about strategy in design? I'd love to know more about what that looks like. And do you teach selling strategy all on its own and that everyone should do that and how?
I'm going to be just super frank and transparent here. I came late to the idea that a designer can participate in the dialogue of like the marketing decisions, the communications, the tone of voice, and the strategic things that the business is doing. And there's a good reason why. It's because most of my clients for the 20 plus years in which I've been in business are advertising agencies. They have strategists, they have account execs, they have all kinds of writers and art directors and creative directors who essentially figure out the long-term strategic roadmap for a company, a brand. And you're just seeing like one hair on the cap. That's all you get to see. Or maybe it's a clump of hair, but not much more than that. So I'm not advocating for people who work with ad agencies who do all that planning to like try to elbow your way in. It's like, no, Mr. and Mrs. Creative Director, Executive Creative Director, let me talk to you about strategy. And you'd be barking up the wrong tree. You can contribute, but you got to make sure you're invited and that you're speaking in a way that is respectful and understand that you're only seeing a very small patch of hair on a cat. That all changed about, 20-ish years into running the business. And like a former classmate of mine, Jose Caballé, he had been working in the web space and they use UX design principles to understand who the customers are, the end user, what their needs are, and they're building software. And so it's like, it's a different animal. It's more analytical. It's more strategic. It's not just what it looks like. What it looks like is just pretty far down the line. And so I see this and he's teaching this to me and I start to realize, wait a minute, we all should be having this kind of dialogue if we're going to work with client direct. So now we're going to pivot over to like when you work with clients directly, there's a couple of things that you need to know. One is they don't have a clear understanding of what the real problem is. Number two, they probably don't know how to articulate it to you. And number three, especially, they don't know how to use your language to articulate to you what they want and without a clear understanding of the real problem. So whenever someone gives you a task to do, if you're working directly with a client, you need to understand the underlying motivator, even when the clients don't. And the only way that you can do that, as far as I know, is A, to keep an open mind, to be aware of your cognitive biases, and you have many, and then to be able to ask really great, focused, relevant, but open-ended questions that are not leading And if you can learn this skill, and this is a skill, you can build really strong relationships with your clients, but more importantly, you can actually solve or have a shot at solving the real problem. This is how you elevate yourself from what we affectionately refer to as an order taker, like, do you want fries with that, to having a strategic business communication marketing conversation with your client so that you can help them achieve their goal. In this way, you create meaningful impact in their business, and you should be able to capture some fair percentage of the value that you create.
I agree wholeheartedly. I want to ask you a clarifying question. You said, be aware of your cognitive biases when interviewing clients. What do you mean by that?
I did, and you can Google this. I think when I typed in how many cognitive biases do humans have, I think there's something like over 200-ish, 250 different cognitive biases. So there's something called the recency bias. And it means like our brain is focused on what we've been focused on recently. And so we always look at that. And there's the anchor bias, which is, again, whatever piece of information we hear first, we focus too much on. So the biases that you walk in with is oftentimes with creatives, especially if you do identity design, that no matter what the clients say, the solution must be identity design. We've seen this. It's almost comical when it's not you. When it's you, you can't even see it. You don't even understand. It's like, if I make shoes, no matter what you come to me with, a back pain, something in your neck, you can't sleep well, it's always because you need a new pair of shoes and I make the best pairs of shoes in the world. And we always assume that higher end looking things, more luxurious things are what's going to help move the needle. That is also not true, because for different markets, especially if they're trying to sell something that has a different story where luxury goes against that narrative, well, that's a bad thing. So those are some of the biases. I mean, there's so many of them for us to talk about. There's the loss aversion bias. There's a sunk loss fallacy. And I'll tell you what that one is. That one's an easy bias to understand. It's the money pit. Okay, like you buy a house, you and your partner fall in love with it, and you know there's some problems. The roof needs repair. There's some mold, and there's asbestos that you need to remove, and there's a foundation that's cracked and there's leaking. And you get into the house, and because you bought it, you're going to fix this. But at a certain point, you're going to go past the point of no return, in which you have to invest more money than the house is worth. So this is the sunk loss fallacy. Like, in order for us to recover the money that we've already spent, we need to spend more money. You can see this is a little bit foolhardy because it's a money pit. Now, how does that apply in the design sense? When you talk to a client and you agree to drive out to go meet them, say they're 30 minutes away. So you have this meeting that first costs you 30 minutes, but it costs you several hours, sometimes days, to prepare for that meeting. You go to the meeting, you spend an hour talking to them where you're giving your ideas, your insight, you're diagnosing problems. So you're actually creating real value there. Then they say, we'd like to see a proposal. What is your idea? Can you build a budget? So then you go back and you spend days doing that and you send it to them. And then when you submit the budget, say for $10,000, they come back and say, yeah, we only have $3,000 to do that. This is where the sunk loss fallacy come in. You're going to say, I've spent all this time researching, preparing, driving, meeting, giving ideas, writing a proposal, putting together a budget and a timeline. I've lost all that money. The only way I can recoup that is to do the deal for $3,000. Sunk loss fallacy. So the only remedy to this is to spend as little time as possible to find out what their budget is so that you can make a clear decision. I'll show you in one more, just really quickly, the anchor bias, another form of cognitive bias. Client comes to you and says, Chris, we love working with you. Amazing design. Come highly recommended. We have $400 to do this thing. And we're really bringing all our money. We think this is really important. We've cleared out, you know, our schedule. We have $400 to do this. And in your mind, you're like, this is a $12,000 gig. I can't ask for that because they just said they pulled all their pennies together and they have $400 to do this. So you start negotiating against yourself based on the anchor of the initial budget that's presented to you, which is $400. So you're like, I'm going to go crazy. I'm going to ask him for $1,200. So you negotiate it back up and like hemming and hawing. They're like, all right, we'll pay you the $1,200. And you're like, woo, what a victory. But is it? Because that's 1/10 of what you're going to ask for. You came in there thinking 12,000. You agreed to 1,200. So this is another bias that works against you.
Yeah, I like to use that in the opposite direction, right? Have a price point that's just way higher than everything else to anchor those prices right. that you give up so that when I present you with a $20,000 package, well, there's a $50,000 package on my website. So actually, that seems pretty reasonable, right? We can use this to our advantage, too.
That's correct.
So talk to me a little bit about how, because you obviously your experience spans the different sizes of these businesses. I'm speaking primarily to these small businesses. The reason I say 1-2% branding agencies, and I'm even realizing as we're talking, I specify branding as opposed to design because in my experience, we started as a graphic design company. And the only way to sell based on value in my experience trying to sell design was to level it up to strategic branding, right? Where it's not design, I'm bringing strategy. And then as I did that, I got more and more into the business strategy part of it. So now I'm adding business strategy into it. But this is because I'm working with small businesses exclusively. And I find our clients, our smaller businesses, our audience, there's a certain size of business that they really shouldn't go beyond because then they're not speaking to the decision makers. They're speaking to middle management and all the crazy stuff that comes with that. Have you ever found a way for a small business to be able to work with large corporate clients without having to sacrifice their ability to sell based on value and actually manage that project, given the complication of working with corporate type of clients?
Let me see if I understand this. The parameters. One is you're a small business, you're a small creative firm yourself, one or two people.
Yeah.
And the question is, can you work with larger corporations? The answer is absolutely yes. I mean, I consider us still pretty small relative to the size of companies we've worked with. Just a point of reference here. When we were towards the last couple of years of running our service design business before I just ended the company, we were probably about 12 people. We're very lean. One office in Los Angeles, in Santa Monica, 12 people. Our client was a $13 billion corporation and they had this gorgeous office space. And so could we as a small firm work with them? Absolutely. But this has a lot to do with your pedigree. Like, are you like an expert practitioner of what you do? Do you do it at the very highest levels? And have you deliberately decided to keep your firm small, mostly because of lifestyle management, not because you don't know how to work with big clients? Big clients have different needs. The work is almost the same, but they have different emotional, psychological, and kind of needs for safety. It's like they don't want to give you a really big project because you represent a flight risk. Again, you get hit by a truck, they've lost their money with you. Whereas with a bigger company, there's whole systems in place. So they assume that if any one person goes down, they have redundancy. Other people will step in and do the work. And so big companies like to work with big companies or companies who present themselves to be bigger. And that the decision is absolutely yes. Now, in this $13 billion company that we're talking about, did I ever meet the CEO and the founder? No. I saw him. He was sitting right there. But I worked with a chief marketing officer who has the ear of the CEO. She reports directly to him. And so she was the primary decision maker and would only kind of run things by him just like to sign off on and be totally okay with. When we say decision maker is not always the owner and the founder. It's just where does the buck stop? And it stopped with this marketing director and she was great. So yeah, you can work with them. And the funny thing is we beat out companies much more experienced and much bigger than us despite all that. And the way that you do that is you learn how to speak the language of business and marketing, which a lot of creatives do not know how to do, which I'm sure is what you're helping them with, right?
Right. Well, you're also bringing, to your point earlier, a certain amount of clout and authority in this space. They're not going to listen to your strategic ideas if you aren't already bringing that authority, having worked with other companies, maybe not of this size, maybe of this size, but you've demonstrated your proficiency in this space already. Would you agree?
I need to answer this one carefully because demonstrating proficiency in this space, just citing my own reference here, we had zero commercial real estate experience. We beat out every architectural commercial real estate firm who had tons of experience there. And we've done this many, many times. So what you need to do, and I find that this is the great fulcrum or leverage that you can have. Say, for example, you've worked mostly in the consumer packaging goods space. You do food and beverage packaging, right? And then one day a tech company says, well, we need you to do key art for a new video game. Not really related. It's not like you can show a ton of work or any work at all that shows that you understand the needs of the video game market and key art. Very different. Well, normally you would not even be considered. and you went into the presentation showing, here's all my food stuff, like they're going to say this is a total mismatch. And why is that? Because, and I've said this before, I've written about it, clients don't hire the best option, they hire the least risky option. And right now you represent tremendous amounts of risk. And the way that you reduce that risk is you learn how to ask really great strategic business questions. And all of a sudden, their doubts about you start to go away. And you start to build rapport, which can lead to trust, reducing the perception of risk. And so I'll give you the example of how this works in the real world. We had a client who we've worked with for years, have known him for over a decade. They wanted us to work on a commercial for a very important launch of a new product in the game space. They had brought on a very high-level visual effects CG consultant, and they gave us a bunch of questions like, show us all your realistic product hard surface rendering. Tell me how many server node render blades you have. I want to meet the technical director. I want to meet the art director. I want to meet your modeling team. And they had all these technical requirements. I knew based on the size of our company, we don't have any of that stuff. We had none of that. So how can we win without domain expertise, without being able to check off all those things? Now, Blair Ahrens writes in his book, The Win Without Pitching Manifesto, that what you want to do is you want to derail the entire pitch process and get the inside track. So if they ask for certain things and you know you can't answer them adequately, and you know that the competition have 3,000 render blades, they have four technical directors they can just rattle off and they've won awards all over the place. If you play that game, you're going to lose. So you have to embrace and pivot. Okay, this is a business strategy here. So you have to acknowledge, we don't have a technical director that I can refer you to. We don't have a large render farm. We basically just rent that as we need it. We don't have all these things that you want. If that's what you want, we're not the right company for you. That's the embracing. I've heard you. I process everything. I've repeated it back to you. I play it back so you know I'm not just dismissing it. But there's a couple of things I want you to consider. The kinds of things you're asking for have been done in the last 10 years, and it's not a technical challenge to do this kind of work anymore. Number two is, if you look at the body of the work, the first time we ever did anything was the first time we did anything. And we don't have very many cases where we can recall where we failed and we didn't understand the problem and didn't deliver. But the third and the most important thing is, I want you to consider this, is, are you buying technical power or are you buying creativity? Because you're buying creativity, we know how to tell stories. We have great taste, and we've done this with you time and time again. If that's what you're looking for, let's continue the conversation. If it's not, we don't want to waste any more of your time. So now you put them into a position where they have to make a decision about whether or not to continue the conversation. And you're saying, I'm not trying to push my way into it. I'm not trying to prove anything to you. I'm presenting you two big decisions. My job, I said this to them quite literally, my job is to make sure we're doing our job so you're not worried about any of this and you sleep better at night so you can focus on the bigger task. I would consider that a failure if you're sitting here thinking, does Chris have enough render blades? Who's the technical director right now?
Boom. Well, so you, Chris, with your clout and your experience, even if it's not in that space, you can come out guns blazing and you can say that. I love the framing of that, right? You're asking for this. That's really, you're kind of saying that's kind of the wrong question to be asking. You should be asking this question, and this is how I would answer it. How would you, or would you, recommend applying that? Is that usable? Is that doable when you're a very small business and maybe you don't have that kind of authority, right? You're a small business. You're one person, you're two people, and you're pitching to other small businesses. And they're going, well, let me see five other, I don't know, let me see five other lawyers that you've done before I decide if I'm going to hire you. Is this applicable? Can you still use that strategy or not, because you're just not there yet?
I need to make an assumption. And the assumption is, do you do good work? Do you know what you're doing? Are you the best of breed? Because if you're not, none of this stuff matters. Go back to school, go get an apprenticeship somewhere, refine your skills, do a workshop, get some training. Make sure you know how to do it. Because this is all built on, do you know how to do the work? If the answer is yes, we can proceed to the next level. Okay, so can we agree, Pia, that they know how to do the work, right? If they're not, they got to go back to school.
Let me push back on that. Okay. Because when do you decide, oh, you are or aren't an expert? Isn't expertise something that you are constantly ascending and acquiring more of? When do you decide, oh, yes, I am able to do this or I'm not? Like, you're able to do it to the best of your abilities at that point with the price point that you're talking about, right?
Okay. So this is where we're fencing now, and I was going for a kill, and then you like parried, and you're like, how about this, sucker? And I will respond back to that. It's pretty easy. expertise is on a relative scale, but we're not talking about like the only person in the world who could do something. That level of expertise is reserved for one person. But there's a threshold, and once you cross a threshold, then you're considered in the game. And the way that we do this, and I can quickly, this is like a quick check here, fit check for everyone, is gather together a body of work of your peers, your contemporaries that you think you're competing against. All right, assemble them on some big screen somewhere and take a couple of your best projects and put them in there. If you feel like you fit in, then you're good enough. If you're not, you're not good enough. So let's understand it like that. So we understand contextually, relatively speaking, you're good enough to do this work. And the thing that we don't want to do is to live in this state of denial. I have young designers who are like, Chris, I'm just as good as everybody. And they show me their I'm sorry to say it, their ugly ass logos, who clearly they don't understand what they're doing. I'm like, no, you're not even, you're in the Fiverr league right now. I'm sorry. I think you think you're in the majors, you're in the Fiverr. And the reason why is because you're doing all these cute expressive logos. Like if it's for a cat food company, you throw a cat in there. You know, they sell bicycles, there's a bicycle wheel. It's like, we're not illustrating here. You don't understand how to build identities that can last and grow with the company. You're not about ideas, you're about illustrating. There's a market for that, but you're not in the league that we're talking about. So does that answer that first question?
Yes, although I would push back a little bit. I actually have, listen, obviously I have my own opinions of design. I'm not the designer, by the way. You might not know that. My partner is the designer and I'm more of the strategist and the business person. But sometimes when people come to me and their portfolio leaves a lot to be desired, in my opinion, but they've worked with a lot of clients who have paid them, I go, you know, taste is in the eye of the beholder. There is clearly a market for you. I'm not your market, but other people are willing to pay you. And so I can work with that. As long as you have already demonstrated that the market will pay you, then we can build a more profitable business around that. Now, do I also want you to improve your design skills and your strategic thinking and all of that? Of course, I would think that anybody building a business is constantly working on improving their skills. But I don't think those people are not able to build a business for themselves.
Right.
I don't think they have to go back to school is my point.
Sure. So let's talk about that. So yeah. The first measurement, if you're good enough, is to look at the body of work and see if you can hang with your peers, your contemporaries, and the people that you want to compete against. That's a quick fit check. Fit check number two is, have you worked with clients like this before? That's less qualitative and more quantitative. Like, I've worked with Google, I've worked with Xbox and Audi. It's like, oh, we'll work with you. It doesn't matter if your work is good or not. It's irrelevant at that point because you're using a different metric. And we could even use a third measurement, which is everybody that's competing for this opportunity who's being considered all went to Harvard. So you have no portfolio, you've never worked with anybody, but you went to Harvard. We can use different systems in here. I'm saying whatever system you use, just make sure you're good enough. And if you're good enough, then let's move to step two. Is that okay?
Okay, fair enough. I agree with you.
Step two is this. The question is, can you as a small company work with big companies? Yes, you can, because Paul Rand was a one-person operation and he worked with Next, Apple, Steve Jobs, right? He worked with UPS and he was notorious for like, I'm just one person, I'm going to do the work and you get no revisions and you're going to pay me $100,000 and that's it. This is how I work. Take it or leave it.
But he had celebrity status at that point, right?
He did pretty relatively early. So let's move on to the next thing that you talk about, which is like clout. What does clout mean? Is it measurable? And let's talk about it so that we can use the same vocabulary and the terminology. When you say, but you have clout, you have this, what does that mean to you? Because I've debated this as well.
That the audience that you're speaking of has experienced you as an authority. They've experienced your authority either through your content or through just interacting with you. I think you can have clout in somebody's mind without having any authority online because they have interacted with you enough to believe that you have a strategic, critical thinking approach.
Yes. So I think there's at least two ways to look at clout. One is, and I've had this debate with my young protege many, many years ago, and she goes, I can't do what you do because I don't have what you have. I'm like, what do you think I have? Well, you have this portfolio. Look at all these things you've done, all these logos, the logo quilt, the companies you've worked with. Look at these case studies you produce. I'm like, okay. Look at these awards and the magazines you've been published in. All right, okay, cool. I said, let's trade places. give me your portfolio. Give me your lack of publications. Give me your awards. We're going to go meet a client tomorrow. Who's going to get that job, you or me? And then so she's like, well, you would. I'm like, well, I'm walking in with your portfolio now. So this leads us to number two. So everybody always thinks like, I can't do what you do because I don't have what you have. And it's true to a degree, but we're leaving something else entirely like ignored. How do people know that you know what you're talking about? Through the quality of the questions that you ask, how you listen, how you play back, how you respond and think in real time. Now, if you don't have the portfolio, the accolades, the publications, and the PR, the skill you should be working on is how do I become a person who can command a room to listen intentionally and ask the right kinds of questions? Because that's a skill that you can learn. And that is the leveler, right? So it's like, you don't have to have any clout. Let's just say, for example, Pia, you've looked at things that I've done, you've watched my videos, but then you ask me a simple question like, Chris, what do you think about this? And I'm fumbling and mumbling my way through. And you're like, whoa, bro, this is not the same person. He must have his scripted. He must have writers and it's highly edited because he can't string together cohesive thoughts and make things understandable. So one of the great skills of the 21st century, besides having great taste, is your ability to articulate your thoughts. This is where you are going to shine. And many of the creative people who probably follow you are going to hurt a little bit. And I include myself in that group. I am horribly shy and I'm an introvert. I don't like hanging around with people. I don't even want to go out. And I thought the best way to avoid talking to real people is to just do work so amazing that I never have to sell anything. That just the quality of work is just going to take care of itself. And I even remember one semi-painful, semi-traumatic moment in topography class where my professor said, talk about your work. And I refused to. And it was a really awkward presentation. I said, I've done my work. And I looked around the room. I didn't say this, but I was thinking this. Their work sucks. I'm not going to denigrate myself by talking it up because that's what they have to do because their work is terrible. So I've obviously had to overcome this idea that if the work is good enough, you will not have to sell. To a degree, that's true. But to a large degree, it's mostly false. The good work gets you considered for the job. Quality is no longer a highlight or a feature. It's a price of entry. When people understand that, then they have to understand the game now, right? If you want to have a real business conversation with a real business person, you can't expect them to learn your language, you learn theirs. In the realm of art and illustration, yeah, your work is good enough. You just make your stuff and that's what people buy. But if you're a designer trying to solve problems for people who have a varying degree of different kinds of problems, different styles, different needs, then you better learn how to speak the language of businesses. You have to become bilingual, speak the language of art and business. So that's kind of where I'm able to level the playing field, which is I can walk into a room not knowing who the client is, not understanding the problem before I start, with full confidence that by the end of whatever time allotment that we have, with a reasonable client who has some understanding of the problems, who can make some decisions, who kind of wants, knows what they want, but can't articulate it, and that's fine, I have a high probability of onboarding that person as a client.
You just said so many gems. One of the things is thanks for sharing your experience as an introvert and wanting to rely on the work, because I know so many creatives in our audience feel that way. Feel like I just want to do really good work on my own. And it's so important to put yourself out there if you're going to be a business owner. It's fine to rely on your work if you're going to work for a company, if you want to be,
order taker?
The order taker. Yeah. If you're going to you can rely on your work if you're just the order taker because that's all you're doing. But if you're going to be interfacing with clients, you have to be able to show up and bring confidence and bring thoughtful questions. So I just love that so much. And I think that's really important for small businesses who are deciding, should I continue with my business or not? Right. I mean, sometimes people are so avoidant of that. I appreciate that you say to some people, hey, you're a Fiverr level. You got to go back and work on this, because sometimes the truth hurts, but it's like you are going to have to get over these fears. I've certainly had a lot of, stage fright when I started all of this. And I said, this is what it's going to take if I want the business that I want. So I'm going to have to get over this and work through it. And it's really just repetition in my experience to be seen and be okay with it. Do you ever say to people, maybe you're not cut out to have a business if you're not willing to do this?
When I was younger, I would say pretty direct things. I'm a little bit smarter. I'm quite a bit older now. And I want to make sure the person is giving me permission to speak in a way that I think I can help. Otherwise, I don't say those kinds of things anymore. Because the last thing I want to do is come across as a pompous a-hole jerk that's going to be a dream crusher. I'm not a star killer. If you're a star, go do your thing. And so the way that I do it when I do it today is, what do you want to get from our conversation? I need explicit permission from you and direction as to how I can be of service and to help you today. And so if they're a young college graduate, they're going to say, can you look at my portfolio? And then I'll say back to them, can you be more specific than look at your portfolio? And sometimes they'll say silly things like, I just want to know if the portfolio case and the box is good. I'm like, yeah, that looked pretty good. It's professional, but it has, you know, it's not dirty. And they're like, great. And then they just leave. And I think, what a waste of my time and your time. That's all you wanted? That's fine. But I want to be invited and for them to tell me the level of pain they want to hear. This way they know if I say something positive, that it's not me blowing smoke up their butt. I care about you, so I care to tell you the truth, but only if you give me permission. So I'm not going to go there and say, this is fine. This is, you know, if you're my student, I'd fail you right now. Like I'm talking about in school, not even professional work. I mean, I will say what has to be said so that they understand. And sometimes I tell people, you know, you're actually very passionate about photography and you actually have real skill here, but you're trying to work in this other space where you can get slaughtered every single day of the week. That's a decision you need to make. A lot of times we try to be something that we're not, but I can see real skill here and it's, you need to make this decision. Every once in a while, they do hear me and they change their careers and they actually have much better results. It's hard to hear at the time, but you know.
I'm going to take that with me. I don't ask for that permission. I'm kinder than I sound like I am, but yes. I do want to be honest with people, because if somebody tells me I want to grow this business, but I don't ever want to be seen or talk to anybody, I go, well, I'm not sure that that's going to work for you, right? Like it seems like a core piece of building any business is that the business owner has to be willing to put themselves out there. I just want to ask you this last closing idea, because I saw it in your content at some point. You shared the Japanese term shuhari, and it was so beautifully summed up things that I've been trying to articulate for a while. Would you mind sharing your interpretation of that or what that means?
Full disclosure, I'm Vietnamese. I'm not Japanese. Japanese people get upset at me sometimes like, Chris, you butchered it. You've appropriated an idea that you effed up. Not necessarily this part, but I'm sure they're going to come out with knives. I personally love Japanese culture. There's so many beautiful things. And if you talk about a culture that embraces the idea of doing humble things well, it's deep within their culture and their psyche. So having said that, somebody had shared this idea. A Frenchman actually shared this idea with me. He's like, Chris, what you're saying is shuhari. I'm like, what? So I have to go look it up on the internet. And depending on what you read, it's a little bit different, but there's just three phases and it's a lot to do with learning. And it's an application of martial arts, okay? So if you're learning from a master, the first part you need to do is just to listen, you need to obey, you need to just to copy. So when the master shares something with you, try to do it as faithfully the way that you're instructed to the best of your ability, and that's it. So in the phase of shu, it could last 10 years. It could last much longer than that. If you're learning Brazilian jiu-jitsu or you're learning Kenpo karate, whatever, it could take you years to do it. And it is also reflected in pop culture. I mentioned the Karate Kid before. Daniel LaRusso, getting his ass kicked all the time, finds Mr. Miyagi, who then defends him while he's getting beat up by these six or seven bullies, right? The Cobra Kai. And he goes, please, will you teach me karate? And he's like, nope. Because he thinks you're an impatient, impetuous kid, and you're not going to follow the Japanese way, the Okinawa way of learning karate. He's begging him, please, Mr. Miyagi, please teach me, because I do it under one rule. He goes, anything, what's the rule? Do everything I say, do not question a single thing I say. He goes, he's so desperate. He's like, well, of course, please, I'll just do it. First day, wash the car. He's like, what? Or paint the fence. And he's like, I want you to paint it a very specific way. And he looks at him with like a scornful, judging eye, like, no, do it like this, do it like this, like this. And Daniel can only do this for so long. He's like, you just got me doing crap. When are we going to learn karate? And then Miyagi, kind of indignant, is like, shut up, kid. Paint the fence. And he tries to hit him. They're like, wax on, wax off. And he shows him. This is how you learn. Here's the difficult part. In the creative space, as divergent thinkers, we don't think there's one way to do something. We think there are many ways to do something. Also, we tend to be kinesthetic learners, which is, I know you said that works, but I need to experience it myself to know it doesn't work before I agree to do this. It makes us the most difficult people to teach, the most stubborn, and also the most painful process in which to learn. Now, for whatever reason, even though I'm a creative person, I can escape this. I'm like, oh, you said do this? I'm just going to do it. You said jump? I'm going to jump. I don't even need to know how. I don't need to know the whys. I just do. So this is why I'm a very good student. And this is why most students in the creative space suck. They're terrible because they are like, well, that works for you, but that don't mean it's true. I mean, there's a lot of ways it is. I'm like, okay, so you'll do it the hard, painful way. So if I was Mr. Miyagi, I'd kick you out of the class. I wouldn't even accept you. So what we can learn from this concept, Shuhari, which is the first part is just to copy, to be a faithful practitioner of whatever it is you teach. Just do it exactly this way. Then you move into the ha phase, which is now you need to learn from multiple masters, okay? So if you're a journeyman blacksmith, you would learn the skill, how to forge a fire or whatever it is. And then you would go to the next thing, how to like temper metal. And then you learn all these things and you're repeating this. And then you're going to combine these ideas together. And then you reach the re stage, which is you're going to make something new, a little bit different. You're going to add your own style, but there's a process here. And it's probably like a pyramid where the shu phase lasts really long. It's deep, it's thick. And then you go to the ha and you're like, you're combining, you're trying and testing, you're trying to disprove different ideas. And then once you walk away with that kind of knowledge, and this is the Bruce Lee part, he took functional martial arts and he adapted it for the real world. He wasn't a strict traditional person. He would learn wrestling. He would learn lots of different things. He would just do what works. He then creates Jeet Kune Do. And that's the stage in which you want to reach. But so many people want to go straight to, I'm going to invent my own thing, that they F up everything else. My kids are like this. My wife's like this. Everybody's like this. Every person I've ever coached is like this, with the exception of a few. And I found a pattern. People who are ex-military, for some reason, are very good at learning. I think it's the discipline, the rigor, the whole, we're going to break you down, strip you of your identity. You're going to wake up when we tell you to. You're going to eat when we, and then you learn like, wow, this works. You know, it's an amazing thing. If you study how boot camp works in the military, they can take, you know, delinquents, not murderers, but they can take like people who have no discipline, no skill, and they can turn them into something much greater. Now, there's some negative parts to this, of course. We stop thinking for ourselves, but for the part of learning and teaching, they've figured this out. And martial arts studios, they've also figured this system out.
I love that so much. How to be a great student so that you can achieve re eventually. If you stick with it. Chris, thank you so much for coming on the show and taking the time. I really, really appreciate it. I've loved this conversation, and I know my audience appreciates it too.
Thank you so much.
I hope you enjoyed this episode. I'll be back next week with more no BS tips for your agency so you can find more profit, ease, and freedom. The No BS Agency podcast is produced by Yellow House Media. Coordinator is Lou Blazer. This episode is edited by Marty Seafelt. Creative direction by Sean and Tara McMullen. Our theme music is Knock 'Em Down by The Shrugs.